This is the Monday Morning Quarterback Podcast with Andy Benoit and your host, John Engel.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the MMQB Podcast. I'm John Engel at Engel's Angle on Twitter, along with Andy Benoit at Andy underscore Benoit. Later in the show, we'll have Greg Bedard joining us to talk a little Andrew Luck. Go head-to-head with Andy on their opinions on the young gunslinger. But first off, let's get started with Philadelphia Eagles on the road at the Green Bay Packers. Aaron Rodgers coming off a fantastic offensive performance against the Bears. How do you stop Aaron Rodgers right now, Andy? Is there any way to do this?
I don't know if there is, because what makes Rodgers unique, and there are small hints, in fact, Andrew Luck might be the only other guy like this, and Rodgers is more so like this than Luck. He can make throws incorrectly and make perfect throws. Rodgers is not the most fundamentally sound passer in the league, and that may be where he separates himself from Luck. He has a lot of flaws in his techniques and mechanics, in fact. His feet are rarely set when he makes a throw. He can be a little frenetic in the pocket. At times, and it's hard to know without knowing how the guys are being taught, but at times I wonder if he's going through the progressions in the smoothest order. There's he's very sandlot oriented, and that can be when a guy like that is rolling the way he is, because he can still play within structure, but he is a structured sandlot player, and that kind of thing is incredibly dangerous and almost impossible to defeat. And the other guy like that is the guy who also has thrown 6 touchdowns in a game lately, Roethlisberger. And then you have Luck, who I think is less like that than those two. He's a little more structured. But anyway, what I'm getting at is, as a defensive coach, how do you plan for that? When a quarterback is capable of killing you by doing the wrong thing, then how do you plan for that? Because your whole plan is to try to make a quarterback do the wrong thing. So I think Rodgers is not the guy you try to defeat right now. I think you try to defeat the guys around him.
And the only game you can legitimately point to that Rodgers has struggled in would be against Detroit. And that, what was it, week 3?
Yeah, week 3. And what the Lions did in that game was play a lot of two-man coverage. And two-man is man-to-man with two safeties over the top. And it's extremely difficult to throw against, because with those two safeties over the top, those man-to-man cornerbacks underneath, they can play underneath. They can trail the wide receiver.
They're protected.
They're protected over the top, so they get underneath the receivers, and they're now all of a sudden they're between the receiver and the quarterback. And Green Bay, they're a plus split passing game. Their wide receivers align outside the numbers. And when you do that, you run a lot more isolation type routes, or you can if you get caught with that. And so that's difficult to do against two-man, and maybe we see Philadelphia do something like that.
Well, and at the time, I don't think anyone thought of Detroit as being one of those great man coverage defenses yet, did we?
No, we didn't. So, and that may have caught Green Bay off guard a little bit. I don't know.
Yeah, they may not have known either.
Yeah, because Detroit, I mean, it was this third game of the season, and Detroit's third game under Terrell Austin. We're going to talk about Detroit next, by the way. That's a good football team. The reason Detroit can get away with that, though, is they also have a pass rush that can generate pressure out of just four-man fronts. And the Eagles, they're not that kind of pass rush. They might be able to generate that kind of pressure, but that's not how they play. They're a little more manufactured, a little more blitz-oriented. So maybe two-man is not a typical coverage for Philadelphia.
Well, and that's what I was going to ask you next is, what do you think of this Eagles pass rush? Because we saw it come to life against a struggling offensive line against Carolina, and now Connor Barwin has 10.5 sacks. Do you see this Eagles pass rush being successful against the Packers?
Yes, because it's a relentless pass rush, and I think when you play the Packers, you're going to have plays go late into the down. Rodgers will extend the play. Things get a little bit outside of structure, as we talked about, and the Eagles have the pass rushers. They have the horses to compete late in the down. We saw that Monday night against Carolina, against Cam Newton, another guy that can extend plays late in the down. Now, Carolina's offensive line is bad right now, and Green Bay's is actually pretty good. I like David Bakhtiari a lot at left tackle. I think he's gotten better. And inside, TJ Lang and Josh Sitton are playing very well. And Lindsley, the rookie center, is doing very well. So I think what we're going to see, though, is Philadelphia, they have Trent Cole. They have Vinnie Curry off the bench, Brandon Graham off the bench. Barwin, you mentioned, who, by the way, has also been excellent not rushing the passer.
Yeah,
playing underneath coverage, run support. As a spy. A lot of his sacks Monday night against Newton came as a quarterback spy.
Or just mowing people over.
Yeah, he's a great player. I had him second team all pro, and if you put him first team, I wouldn't argue with it. Maybe they have him spy Rodgers. I don't know. I think we're going to see a variety of tactics because the Eagles have been – they might be the high – their offense we talk about is very simple. They don't run a lot of different plays. They just run them out of different formations and very fast. Their defense, they do a lot of different things. They might have the thinnest playbook offensively and the thickest one defensively, and I would expect them to throw a lot at the Packers.
Well, and we've talked about the success of the Detroit Lions. That front four has been incredible, and the Eagles are having a similar success with their push. The Lions are on the road with the Cardinals, and we'll get to Drew Stanton being that new starting quarterback after Carson Palmer going down. Sad to see him out for the season, but first, can we talk about the Lions? Four straight games. In the last three, they won by a combined 6 points, and all in these waning seconds of the game. Is this something we can believe in when these games are coming down to the wire like they are for the Lions?
Well, I think a win is a win in the National Football League. It's
sure,
just add
yeah.
this to the growing and humongous list of reasons why pro football is better than college football. A win is a win in pro football. We don't have to analyze the win. It was, you know, was it
head
a quality
heads,
win, quality
yeah.
loss? It, whatever. It's a little bit. It's a battle for 60 minutes, and it contributes to the greater war that is the league. Not to be using a crass term here, but but you get what I'm saying. So Detroit's look. They're 7-2. You are what your record says you are. Matthew Stafford's having a great season. His numbers might be. I think they're around the worst of his career, if I'm not mistaken. I think he's having one of his best seasons, though.
Okay, in the fourth quarter with 4 minutes or less remaining, Stafford has a quarterback rating of over 144. That's incredible. Now, my question for you, though, is offensive coordinator Joe Lombardi keeping things a little simpler in the beginning stages of the game to get this momentum for Stafford? Because
Game plans don't quite work like that.
But it seems like late in games, they're really finally letting him loose and they take it easy early on. Am I wrong there?
Well, I don't want to say they take it. I know what you're asking. We don't want to, I mean, you're not saying, but we don't want to say they're taking it easy.
No.
Teams don't take it easy.
Making it simpler.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what I mean.
Well, Lombardi's offense has not been, he came from the Saints, and I think a lot of us expected we'd see some Saint-type stuff, and it really hasn't been that much of Saint stuff. There's been more condensed formations and more base personnel or two-back sets or no more than three receivers on the field at times. But overall, it's a mix of what the Lions have done before and then what some of the stuff Lombardi did bring over from the Saints. And I think Stafford gets very comfortable when you just kind of let the reins off of him. One defensive coordinator told me he's a wild stallion. And a lot of coaches like to have that because they believe they can tame the wild stallion. And I think Lombardi has tamed him to a certain degree. But when you take those reins off and you let him be his natural self, be that stallion, what you do in the game situations, because a lot of it's hurry up. So you're running your base plays. You're not dipping into the playbook deep. You're going with what you practice the most out of your hurry up offense. You're probably spreading out and you're creating more defined progression reads, and then you're taking more chances with the ball, which is something Stafford's very comfortable with. He just happens to be succeeding with it all right now. And the thing about your stat, it's impressive. Those can swing pretty quickly too, because there aren't a lot of final 4 minute passing situations in NFL games. I mean, I don't know how many attempts he has in those, but it can't be more than, 80. And
sure.
it's not a ton. So, anyway, but Stafford's taking care of the ball for the duration of regulation for the most part, and that's something that hasn't always been the case.
So now, obviously, the Cardinals are having to go with Drew Stanton out of necessity. Carson Palmer out for the year, as we mentioned. He was 2-1 as a starter, but, I mean, for the season, he's not even completing 50% of his passes. Do you still think that the Cardinals are a legitimate Super Bowl threat? I mean, that's what we're hearing, is that the Cardinals are still confident that they are that team, that 8-1 team that could do something special in the playoffs.
Well, Stanton, he's been very good. He was very good on third down. And so even though his completion rate's low, I venture to say it's probably pretty high on third down. I know he had a lot of success, especially in the second half of, I believe it was his first start. I struggle with Drew Stanton because I can see the solid backup ability being there. And by that, I mean a guy that you can turn the ball, hand the ball to for the season.
If you need him a couple weeks.
Yeah, which they need to write him out. But that, you're right. The completion percentage, that is a factor, and that is symptomatic, or you know, symptomatic of something. He needs to get a little quicker getting to his check down at times, which I think he will. He's helped in the system by it's a really good passing system, and the route combinations are excellent. We don't know a lot about him reading the field in that regard because he hasn't played a ton in his career, but I would assume he understands those route combinations because Bruce Arians brought him over very early or very deliberately when he got the Cardinals job.
Do you want me to tell you what his third down completion percentage is? Because I know you're not a stats guy. You might
what
be a little
it?
Surprised. It's 53%.
Is that all?
No, it's almost 53.8.
Wow, because I know he was I do have some stats in my notes here, John.
Oh, surprising.
I'm pulling up my Stanton notes right now, right here on the fly. Stanton 5 for 5 for 93 yards and a touchdown on third down in the second half. That was against the 49ers, a game the Cardinals won 20-16. You know, we'd have to go back and look at the numbers and all that,
sure.
Or look at the plays. But he was 8 out of 13 on third down and the Niners game overall. So that was the game I was thinking of.
Do you think it's worrisome for the Cardinals going up against a defense like Detroit's that's been so good in man coverage and been so stout in almost every facet with Drew Stanton as your quarterback?
Yeah, a little bit, because Detroit can take away your running game. And they're going to make Stanton, those third down throws, I don't know what the distance was on those. I don't remember. It's been so long. But how is Drew Stanton? At some point, he's going to have to complete third down and 10, third down and 12, third down and 8, and he's going to have to do it with some regularity. And that was something that Palmer always gave him the chance at because he was such a good progression reader. He had a decent arm, and he was willing to stay in the pocket. Now, if you have to figure out, is Stanton that kind of guy? And if he's not, then Bruce Arians will have to amend what is so far an excellent system.
Andy, in our Sunday night primetime game, we'll get to the quarterbacks here eventually, obviously, because, you know, Tom Brady and Andrew Luck coming to the table with this Patriots-Colts game, it's undeniable to go that direction. But
right, we'll do that with Bedard. Later.
Yeah, and he's going to shed some good light on Luck, of course. But let's first talk about these defenses. The Patriots in the passing game have performed pretty well, and this might be a good scenario for either Luck to prove that he can beat better passing defenses or the Patriots to prove that they're the real deal on defense.
Yeah, but I mean, both teams are going to be challenged here because we're talking about talented quarterbacks.
And maybe finally a good primetime game, one that's not a blowout.
20 of the primetime, I had one of my researchers, Brian Knowles, look this up for me. 20 of the primetime games this year have been decided by 14 or more points.
Oh,
that's well over half the games. And most of those 14-pointers were actually 20-something pointers. It's been the worst year I've ever seen for primetime football. I mean, it's nice if you want to turn the game off kind of early, if you live on the East Coast,
yeah,
I guess.
Go to bed.
But, as far for this game, I don't think we'll see a blowout on this one because you have quarterbacks that can keep their team in it. But to answer your question about the defenses – both are man. I love man-to-man defense, as you know.
Yeah,
for one, it's easier to watch on film because you can just see the guys and see who's playing well.
Who gets beat? Who doesn't get beat?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, to a large degree, yes. And both are man-to-man defenses. Interestingly enough, both of these offenses are very good at defeating man coverage through designed plays, through scheme things like stack release and motion. For both of them, really, Patriots are very good in stack release. Colts do some stuff out of motion. They're both very, very good out of trips, bunch sets, and having their receivers line up and intersect their routes, and one goes in one direction, one crisscrosses here, another goes up the seam, and now all of a sudden everything's discombobulated, and the quarterback knows where they're going, but the defenders have to sort it out, that kind of thing. And they all have good route runners executing these things. So we're going to see both of these defenses get challenged a lot as man-to-man teams. And the last note where the similarities are, and then, you know, you can just watch the game and view for yourself how it goes. I don't know who's going to win.
Yeah, this is a hard one.
Yeah, they both have these – not only are they man-to-man defenses, they both have a shutdown corner. Darrell Revis for New England and Vontae Davis who's playing even better than Revis. In fact, he's playing better than – he might be playing better than every corner in the league if I actually stop and think about it. He's having a sensational season for them.
You know what's kind of hard too is I like that you're not a stats guy when referring to defenses, because these statistical numbers for teams that rely on man coverage are hard to read. So like the Patriots are 14th in opposing passing yards per game, 235, but that doesn't tell how well they've played this season. And the Cardinals are really high too, and they've played great in man coverage.
Or the Colts, you mean? Or you're talking about Arizona?
No, I am talking about the Arizona Cardinals. Just on a tangent, kind of to relate these two.
Yeah, and we've talked about that before, and some of that gets inflated by a bad game here or there. New England's always high on pass defense yards allowed. They're a bend but don't break defense. They're not these multiple complex go out and attack your defense. It's not very often. They are fundamentally sound, and they'll give you some field position, but they're not going to let you score.
And we'll get to these quarterbacks then later when Greg joins us. But first, let's get to Seattle Seahawks, Kansas City Chiefs, 2-6-3 teams. One seems to be a bit overachieving, the other underachieving. Andy, how do you see the overachieving Chiefs going about attacking this Seahawks defense that ranks actually third in the NFL in yards allowed per game at 307 yards per game? But we still look at Seattle as a kind of a faltering defense, right?
Well, they've had some injuries, and so they don't look as threatening as before.
Depth has hurt.
But the guys that are coming up from the back end, as we've talked about, I think we talked about this last week, they've been just fine. They've been actually very good.
A lot like the Chiefs.
Yeah, Chiefs have had some next man up as well on defense with Derek Johnson going out and Muaga coming in at linebacker, and then Abdullah, who was, I think, probably going to start anyway, but taking on a bigger role in Eric Berry's absence. And now that they're both back, the Chiefs have gone to more dime stuff again with Kurt Coleman getting some reps on the field. And actually, it's a four safety dime because Ron Parker slides out to cornerback, which is a position he played in training camp. It's a team that has forced depth upon itself in the secondary, much like Seattle has. And so how do I see this? But to answer your question, the Chiefs offense attacking the Seahawks defense, we know we're going to get defined reads for Alex Smith, and we know we're going to get some misdirection stuff with DeAnthony Thomas.
As usual.
Yep, we're going to get some screens for Travis Kelce, screens for Jamal Charles, some little hook routes for Dwayne Bowe. It's a matter of how you put them all together, and I think the key guy is going to be Kelce and whether he can win matchups against those Seahawks safeties. And if Cam Chancellor's back and at full strength, then that's going to be a real fun one to watch. Even if he's not at full strength or if he doesn't play, I don't know his status. He's been out the last two games, I believe. Kelce's the key guy. You get the ball to Kelce.
Yeah, and you mentioned the defined reads for Alex Smith, and they've been very successful with these short and intermediate routes. And Alex Smith ranks third least in yards per passing attempt. I think that's interesting, and that kind of fulfills that narrative of those short routes then among starting quarterbacks that are still active starting quarterbacks. That's with Derek Carr and Ryan Tannehill. So, I mean, beating this Seahawks defense that usually plays over the top seems perfect for Alex Smith and the Chiefs, right? Or am I looking at this too black and white?
Well, I don't think it's ever perfect to go into the Seattle Seahawks defense.
that's a good point. Yeah.
that's a tough one. So I wouldn't say it's perfect. I would say it's far from perfect, but Kansas City's equipped to compete in this one, and they can run the ball. And I'm really interested to see how Seattle's run defense reacts now that Brandon Mebane is out, because that might be one injury that they cannot overcome. He does a lot of hidden dirty work for them and controls the way blocking schemes unfold. And so if he's out of the lineup now, it's Jordan Hill and Tony McDaniel together, and I don't know who plays the nose shade on that. McDaniel has experience at defensive end, so I don't know if he's equipped to be a nose shade guy. Maybe Kevin Williams comes in at nose shade. He's been a career-long three technique. We don't know much about Jordan Hill, third-round pick a year ago. He hasn't played a whole lot. Maybe he's the nose shade guy. I'm very interested to see how this goes. They have questions they have to answer here, and that's Kansas City has an excellent center too in Rodney Hudson. So that's something we'll see the Chiefs at least try to make the Seahawks prove themselves about.
Well, and we always see these week to week adjustments, but on defense, the Seahawks stay pretty consistent in the way that they defend teams. Do you see a change happening this week in order to stop the Chiefs?
No, I mean, the Chiefs are not an offense that you adjust your system for by any.
Yeah, but
they're one you fine-tune your system against, in fact.
Okay, well, then I think the heart of my question then is allowing a lot of these underneath routes like the Chiefs do, I don't see the Seahawks stopping them then if you just keep everything in front of you. I mean, that just seems great for the Chiefs. I don't know. Maybe
no,
they just love
this. No, I don't
think
so, John. I disagree, because that was Seattle's mantra in the Super Bowl. Is Denver might get their catches, but they're not going to get any yards after the catch whatsoever.
You're right.
And Seattle's a great tackling team. They're fast to the ball. Alex Smith is not a tight window passer, so we don't even know if those throws will be there. I don't think this is a great matchup for the Chiefs. I think it goes back. They have two guys that can really create problems. Well, they have three. Jamaal Charles is a playmaker, but they have two guys in the passing game that can create problems through gadget-type designs, and that's Kelce and DeAnthony Thomas, and I think Kelce's the key guy there.
We'd be remiss if we didn't bring the Russell Wilson factor in at least once a podcast. Do you see maybe Tamba Hali and Justin Houston having to be a little less aggressive
to kind of contain
him? How do you see that working out?
I see it working out the way you said. They'll have to be a little less aggressive. Kansas City might employ a spy on Wilson. I think I'd like to see them do something like that. I don't know who it would be. Maybe Barry, maybe Abdullah, maybe one of those linebackers. You know, James Michael Johnson, he won't be in on the sub packages, though. This is the problem Russell Wilson presents to you, is how do you defend him? And if you want to defend him on the edges, then now we're talking about mitigating your pass rush a little bit. And if you want to defend him with a spy, well, then who's going to be the spy? And it's hard to figure out. And the Giants last week did not figure it out. And that's why I think the Chiefs we could see them be a little mush rush on the edges, because the Giants were so bad at defending Wilson on the perimeter. And it's not just as a scrambler now. Wilson's being used more as a foundational piece of the running game. Read option stuff. He had some new quarterback keeper designs on rollout looking things, or out of run action where you fake the handoff and get to the outside. That's a whole nother animal to deal with. And Kansas City, they'd better have a specific plan for. They better have two, in fact, in case the first one doesn't work.
And to the Seahawks NFC West foe, the St. Louis Rams are hosting the Denver Broncos, and Rams head coach Jeff Fisher has elected to bench Austin Davis for Sean Hill this week.
I think Austin Davis has elected. I think Davis elected that to make Fisher bench him. He had no decision. And I know I was an Austin Davis proponent early on. He's gotten worse every single start. The limitations have showed more and more. And a few weeks ago against, I forget who they were, it was the Niner game. They won in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
He started reading the field incorrectly at times and seeing things that, frankly, a pro quarterback should see. Things like how to manipulate a safety when there's only one wide receiver to that side of the field. He had an interception on plays like that, and he came out in this last game against Arizona and played frenetic. He was frenzied from the start, and they started changing the type of reads they asked him to make because of it. That's all limiting stuff. And then when they had to get back to throwing to him, he threw those interceptions. Not the second one wasn't his fault. The first one to Patrick Peterson was an inexcusably bad pass, bad mechanics. There was no decision here to make. Austin Davis, you can't put him in the next week after he plays the way he has lately.
Well, and you'll like this. According to ESPN, the Rams have allowed 6 defensive touchdowns this season, 4 from Austin Davis interceptions and 2 from Austin Davis fumbles. And 13 NFL teams haven't allowed a single defensive touchdown.
Yeah, things go the wrong way against you at times. Again, I'm always careful with stats because, like, I think about, well, is it really fair to say 6 of them are on him? Because one of them, Kenny Britt tipped the ball just a little bit on a slightly high pass, and whose fault is that? It went right into Patrick Peterson's hands. The other one, the sack fumble that Cromartie took to the house that sealed the win. Austin Davis had absolutely nowhere to go with the ball.
Yeah, he had to step up.
Every single route was plus 20 yards downfield except his outlet route, and the outlet receiver out of the backfield stumbled a bit and got smothered. So Davis steps up, and that's what he's looking at, and his pocket collapses. There's nothing else that can happen but for the quarterback to get hit. And he got drilled by the rookie, Martin, the defensive lineman, who's 100 pounds heavier than him, and the ball came out. So, John, I don't know if I want to say, well, he has 6 turnovers that went the other way against him, because 2 of them we can say were just circumstantial. What really bothers me is the way he was frenetic and frenzied for no reason. He had no pocket poise. He looked small in the pocket, like that Jimmy Clausen used to do that, where he's 6'3", but he looks 5'11 in the pocket. He doesn't play big. Eyes aren't downfield. That's the stuff that can't happen in the NFL.
Well, and you mentioned that Austin Davis almost made Jeff Fisher bench him, but I don't get the point of bringing in Sean Hill at this stage of the season. You're 3-6. Do you really think the Rams are going to grab a wild card spot? What's the point of not just letting Austin Davis take this and seeing what Austin Davis can give you?
Well, they've seen what he can give you. They've seen it. Austin Davis is an undrafted guy, so there's a reason for that. Everybody scouted him. It's not like he was unknown and then didn't get drafted. He wasn't like a computer salesman that happened to throw.
If neither are your future, why put in Sean Hill?
Well, who else are you going to put in?
Just keep.
There's literally
keep
no
Austin
other quarterback
Davis
on the roster. No, because Austin, what message are you sending the rest of your team then when the guy plays that poorly and doesn't? He didn't give him a chance to compete at times against Arizona. And I don't mean to say he's not a competitive guy. He plays hard. I think he's willing to take hits. He throws on the run, all that stuff. But, John, there were cases where this offense worked and the ball didn't go remotely close to where it should have. What do you tell the other 10 guys on offense? How do you get your whole team then to play hard and buy in if the stuff's not working and the coaching staff doesn't do anything about it? This is the same reason Tim Tebow doesn't have a job.
Okay, I guess I just read this wrong then, thinking that it was more of a desperation move by Jeff Fisher,
no,
saying I'm probably gone after this season if I don't make a move here.
Well, I don't know if Jeff Fisher thinks like that at this point. He's had a long
career.
He's been
around a while.
For some reason, he gets hired in a heartbeat. He hasn't had a ton of winning seasons to his name, but he's regarded around the league as an exceptional coach. And so his job security, whether it's here or somewhere else, I think he's okay there. This isn't a desperation move. He's just trying to find a quarterback where they could play football with.
And no quarterback issues in our next game. The Bengals are on the road with the New Orleans Saints, but Andy Dalton is coming off arguably, I guess it's not too arguable that it was the worst game of his career.
Yeah, he was bad. I mean, everything about that game Thursday night was bad. I think you almost just chalk that up to a clunker and move on. I mean, what are you going to go through the tape and try to fix everything? What happened was the Browns secondary was exceptional that night. And
you got a man coverage defense there that you can fall in love with too.
And it's a two-man coverage. They do a lot with the two defenders over the top, man-to-man. I think we'll see the Saints do the same thing. I think that was such a thorough butt-whooping that you'd almost be silly not to at least attempt the same thing and come out and make the Bengals prove that they can beat you when you're in man coverage. And the Saints have good man-to-man defenders too.
Well, when you say you want to just chalk that up to, I guess exclude that game is just a
not
terrible game.
Not exclude it, but I mean, how they say sometimes you burn the tape?
Well,
I think you just kind of move on.
So then do you burn the tape for the last four games when Andy Dalton's thrown two touchdowns to six interceptions? I mean, how much tape do you have to burn here?
Well, no, you don't burn all four games of tape. Of those four games, two of them were deplorable. That Browns one and then the Colts one back in week 7. And that one was more of an offensive line issue, and Dalton couldn't compete because the guys up front weren't helping him out at all. I go back to, and I know this is silly to go to just one play, but that 53-yard play that Dalton threw against, I think it was a 53-yard, may have been, it was some long play, late in the game to Mohamed Sanu. That was an arm-strength throw. That was the exact type of throw. It was big-time athleticism from the pocket. It was the exact type of throw that I've always thought Andy Dalton cannot make, and he did make that one. And that was very uplifting to me. So now on the flip side of that, the limitations of Dalton, his mechanics are a little inconsistent, and that affects a lot of his throws, and we've seen that consistently over the years. And so right when you think that ceiling goes away, that uplifting throw, you see it come back the next week with some of those inconsistencies. I'm not sure what you do with that, but here's what I do know is Andy Dalton is their guy for right now, and he's their guy for this season. And so it's on Hugh Jackson to build around him and find ways to get him comfortable. And I think getting him comfortable, whenever Giovanni Bernard gets back in the lineup, I think that will help because that'll give them more of a screen game again. And I think you have to find defined reads for Dalton, a few less progression passes.
Well, and Hugh Jackson is also going to have to find out how to beat man coverage, because these three losses that Andy Dalton has to New England, Indianapolis, and Cleveland, those three teams we've talked about this very podcast,
yep,
can play good man coverage. And if you're saying that New Orleans can play that same defense as Cleveland,
it's
then it's an issue. Yeah.
And the only game out of that four-game stretch that they didn't face a man coverage team was Jacksonville, and they had some great route concepts against Jacksonville's cover three, which a lot of teams have had this season, by the way. Man coverage, I think you made the point. I think we're going to see the Saints play that. I think Keenan Lewis will shadow A.J. Green. He'll probably get some help at times. And it's going to be on Hugh Jackson to find – you can manufacture offense against man coverage. We talked about it with Patriots and Colts and all the things they do to beat man coverage. Hugh Jackson's going to take a page from that. They already have that stuff in the offense. Hugh Jackson's a good coordinator. But you got to get easy reads for Dalton early on. And the nice thing is the Saints' pass rush is not all that threatening. And if they're playing man-to-man, then you're probably not going to see – you might see some cover – you might see some blitzes, I guess. But I don't think we're going to see a ton of blitzes.
Well, and the Houston Texans will have a similar challenge going up against the Browns this week, 6-3 for Cleveland. And the Browns are coming off that thrashing of the Bengals in their first place in the AFC North. Are they actually the division's best team, though? I think that's a fair question.
I think
question.
So. I had to do the midseason picks for Sports Illustrated this week. And I had
that
to
was a hard one this year.
It was, and I did the picks right before week 10 last week because the magazine comes out, prints on like a Tuesday or something, maybe late Monday night. So I did the stuff going into the weekend and thinking like, okay, let's, you know, hopefully this holds true and they won't have to change things on Monday up against the deadline. In the AFC North, I had to totally rewrite because as we saw how Pittsburgh played over the weekend against the Jets and Baltimore, I've cooled on them significantly because Jimmy Smith is out for the season.
That's huge.
Yeah, that is huge. And they got a bye week now, so we won't see it. But I think that's going to hurt that defense a lot. So those two teams are shaky. Cincinnati, how could you possibly pick Cincinnati ahead of Cleveland based on what we just saw Thursday? Wouldn't make sense. I think Cleveland is the best team in the AFC North, and they're going to get Josh Gordon back soon. They're going to get Jordan Cameron. I always forget which one. Cameron.
Jordan
we're talking
Cameron.
Saints just a second
there
ago.
We go.
We're getting Jordan Cameron back soon, and they're also going to have a healthy Andrew Hawkins. So the best team in the AFC North potentially, they've survived all that. They're going to get their three best receivers back.
Okay,
and Gordon's going to change that offense.
That's what I was going to ask. I mean, it may sound crazy to talk about Josh Gordon, a guy as talented as Josh Gordon, maybe throwing off the offense, but is there a chance that happens? Cleveland's kind of found a mold here.
I think that question you're talking about is more, that's a basketball question where it's team chemistry. You put a new guy in the lineup, and yeah, he might be the best player, but everyone changes around him. It's different with a wide receiver because – it's different if you are disciplined. Here's what happens when you put Josh Gordon outside. The coverage becomes two-man over the top or cover two to that side of the field. It forces that. Now, it doesn't mean it's cover two across the board, but to that side of the field is help over the top. And when there's help over the top, it means half the field's accounted for, and you're more likely to get something kind of vanilla on the other side. It's going to just define the coverages more. Now, if you start throwing deep balls to Gordon and really forcing it to him, then yeah, I could throw out the offense. But I think the nice thing about Gordon, I think what they can do is plug him in and say, let's let the defense worry about him and we're going to keep running our stuff because their stuff's working all right. They do moving pockets for Hoyer. I love the way he threw off a play action on Thursday night. His ball cut through the wind. I mean, he showed some real arm strength. And
yeah, you can see the Pettine starting to let Hoyer loose a little bit too.
Yeah, or Schottenheimer too with the play calling.
There you go. Yeah,
but Pettine's in charge of that. Pettine's going to give the go ahead. It's Hoyer's encouraging to me, and now you add Josh Gordon to the mix. But I don't think you want to change the offense to accommodate Gordon. I think you've done well enough here, and you've gotten settled in what you're doing, and they seem to get a little bit better each week. And if you told me that, I mean, obviously no one saw Cleveland being 6-3, but if you told me that I'd be saying this stuff about Cleveland at this stage of the season, I never would have believed it in August because this was the worst receiving core in the league coming into the season, and they've been just fine with these guys.
Well, I will give us credit that we did spot that the Cleveland defense was going to be something special. I mean, I think it was kind of easy to see that Cleveland's defense had the pieces in place. I loved watching Cleveland, too, because – you still have this uncertainty. Can I believe in Cleveland at 6-3? Is this real? And we mentioned the running back group and needing to find a featured back. It doesn't look like they need that. Those three running backs there, Terrence West and Ben Tate and Isaiah Crowell, it's just,
yeah,
it's fun.
I think they'd like one of those guys to emerge, but so far it hasn't happened. But
they all have these specific roles though within that group.
Yeah, it's not a bad trio, and it helps that those guys can run fresh. You know, I think Ben Tate's one of those guys that has to run fresh, kind of like Sean Green has been throughout his career, especially early in his career with the Jets, where he's just a rotational back. He's not a foundational back. I know for a fact that they targeted Ben Tate well before he was available in free agency, and they. they sought after him because they thought he could be a foundational back. Fortunately, they got Terrence West as well to hedge on that end of things, and he's been good for them.
Well, and the Browns have those three running backs, a team that's been to say they've been short at running back this season would be an understatement. The San Diego Chargers are hosting the Oakland Raiders. I guess Ryan Matthews has been practicing this week. That's something to be happy about if you're a Chargers fan.
Yeah. You know, some of these guys you can plug in, though. I mean, Oliver's come in and he's been good. He's been fine. I don't want to dismiss running backs, but you can kind of plug him in. Now, what I like about Matthews is that he has a little wiggle to his run, and he can create some of his own space. But the way the Chargers play, you know, that offense is built around Phillip Rivers. Their running game's pretty basic. It's a lot of just downhill stuff. They don't do a ton of misdirection. So I think you can plug those guys in. Obviously, just like with the Browns not having trouble at their wide receiver position, the Chargers, even though with all these injuries at running back, they survived it okay, although they're not in the hottest stretch right now, certainly. They had a pretty bad showing in Miami.
When it comes to the Oakland Raiders, we can wrap up our AFC games for the week with this. DJ Hayden recently returned to the lineup for Oakland. He's struggled with injuries throughout his whole career. Missed the first six games with a broken foot. I guess he's struggling with a minor groin injury now. Since being drafted 12th overall in 2013, he's missed 15 of 25 career games, Andy. How has he looked, though, when you've seen him actually on the field?
He looked like a rookie last year, but he's looked very good the last few weeks. He can change directions downfield off of his own movement, so he can adjust the balls that way. He can adjust the late movement in routes. He's good on the outside. He plays well in space. He's a natural in his back pedal. I can see why DJ Hayden was drafted where he was, and it's encouraging for the Raiders because also on the other side of him, their seventh-round rookie Carey is looking like a foundational-type cornerback on the outside as well. So they might have...
Well, and he struggled with injuries too, and they've had injuries to Carlos Rogers, so that... I mean, this
means...
Yeah, but
Carey's been in the lineup recently, though.
Right, yeah, you're right. But DJ Hayden's role is going to continue to be increased regardless, right?
Well, I think they're going to... If he stays healthy, yeah. I think they're going to keep Carey and Hayden on the outside as their long-term answers. So I think that's the nice thing is we're talking about two young guys. I mean, second-year guy and a first-year guy. A seventh-round pick, no less, at cornerback. It's hard to find a seventh-round corner who can succeed. Go look at all the positions and which ones have the most success with high draft picks. Cornerback is by far the highest rate for first round success rate and guys percentage of guys who are former first round picks because it's such an athletically demanding position to play.
You know what's funny about this podcast is we never explicitly set out to hit a theme, but I think the theme this week is obviously defenses, and the San Francisco defense is getting Aldon Smith back this week after that 9-game suspension. What do you expect in his return when they're on the road going to MetLife to take on the Giants?
I don't know because I don't know what his conditioning's like. I don't know what he's been doing.
Says he's polished his pass rushing moves, whatever that means.
You know, he might be better than ever. I mean, he really might.
Which is scary for someone who had 43 sacks in 43 career games.
He's had a longer offseason. I assume he's in shape. Now, it's hard to get in football shape, so it might take him a game or two. I would expect his snaps would be a little bit limited in this one. He'll probably only play – I wouldn't be surprised if he only played in the nickel situation, passing situations. This is a potentially big-time changing move for San Francisco's defense because it gives them a natural pass rusher. Aaron Lynch has been good for them on the other side. He's had a fine season. Ahmad Brooks has been much quieter this year than usual. I think if you put Smith back in the lineup, you get a great rotational player in Lynch, not just a good starter, but a great rotational player now. And I think you get a chance to have Ahmad Brooks back to being Ahmad Brooks again.
Well, and the 49ers are another one of those teams that have been fortunate with success in that next guy up scenario. We talked about the Chiefs as being one of those teams as well. But you mentioned there being a dramatic improvement to this Niners team with Smith in the lineup. They're already ranked second in the league in defense, which seems crazy. 306.4 yards per game. How much better can you get?
Well, whoever's first and then just take those yards,
you're
gonna
trade with the Detroit Lions?
No, and Lions, I believe, are up by 30 yards or something.
Something like that, you're right.
It's a pretty far advantage there. They're well into first place. You said next man up. This would be a great time to introduce Chris Borland,
We talked about him last week, too. He had something like 18 tackles two weeks ago.
And they were productive. Yeah, that's right. They were meaningful tackles, not those Barrett Rude tackles. I watched the Niners in Saints film, and Borland stood out even more. Now, he takes some chances. He's a bit of an aggressive guy, but he has the guys around him to allow him to play that way. He's got a good defensive line. His linebacking core, though it's depleted, it's still not a bad one. And his safeties, especially Antoine Bethea, can run the alley and help out in run support. So it's okay that Borland gambles as much as he does, and some of those gambles really pay off because he takes on lead blockers with more ferocity and just meanness than anybody I've seen this year.
Do you want to take a guess at how many tackles he has in the last two games, Saints and Rams?
32.
35. Oh, that was very impressive.
Well, I knew it was 18 from the first one.
Oh, okay. So. Yeah, so 17 the next one.
Yeah, I mean, you always have to wonder who's counting the tackles, what counts, because I know teams count tackles, and if a guy is within arm's length of the ball carrier, he's going to get something.
Yeah.
He's going to get marked up for a tackle. Borland's a good player. I think they found a long-term solution here at linebacker when they didn't necessarily need one right away. He was drafted to in case of the event that Navarro Bowman wasn't healthy, and it looks like Bowman's not going to be back anytime soon,
yeah.
I'm guessing, which doesn't surprise me, unfortunately. But they're going to have a decision to make about, I don't know what Willis's contract status is, but with Patrick Willis now obviously on IR, that's why Borland's the next man up. At some point, Borland might make them, we're talking way too far ahead in the future, but make them have to make a tough decision with Bowman, Willis, and who goes there, because Borland looks like a long-term solution.
Yeah, so in 2010, I'm seeing Patrick Willis signed a seven-year deal, $53 million, and that was $29 million guaranteed, so that's a lot of guaranteed money.
Yeah, well, it is, but if you divide that by seven, that's a little over $4 million a year against the cap prorated if you were to release him. So
doesn't that sound crazy, making a decision about Patrick Willis at this
stage? I know, and I don't mean
career.
To say, I mean, how old is Willis?
29.
Yeah, so I don't mean to say that that's, what I'm saying is Borland's a guy that you're going to have to put on the field, and where's his place going to be, and they're going to have to figure that out.
Real quickly, does Smith help restore some of that identity on defense that we're used to, that we've been talking about, that that's maybe what's lacked with the Niners, even though the stats are there that they've performed just fine?
Well, that identity you're talking about, John, is it's more. Here's another. We do this every week. It's man-to-man coverage. It's two man, and the Niners have been very good at.
Maybe that's because it works.
Well, yeah, it works if you have the right personnel, and that's why if we stop and look at all the teams that play that kind of coverage regularly, there aren't a ton of them. Cleveland plays it probably more than anybody, I would guess, and they have some of the best personnel. San Francisco has some of the best, has had, not anymore, but they've had over the years some of the best personnel, and it started with Aldon Smith and being able to do those two-man rushing concepts with Justin Smith. The stunts, the twists, with Justin Smith, sometimes just the bull rush and Aldon Smith the speed rush, that was a great duo, and they're still back. I mean, they're back. They're going to be a great duo again, and so maybe we do see a little bit of a return to identity. And Vic Fangio can stop doing as much zone as he's doing, although it is working, and employ more of his straight pass rush. They're not going to have to blitz a whole lot, though, with Aldon Smith back in the lineup, and that's always the good thing.
Well, and across the NFC, the Chicago Bears are a defense that have no identity on defense.
They have an identity. It's just
bad?
They suck.
Is it a bad idea? And they're hosting the Minnesota Vikings this week. Is there anyone we can point a finger at for being at fault for what has happened to the 3-6 Bears this season, or is it just a colossal group effort?
Not going to kick Jay Cutler while he's down. He hasn't had a good
season. They're burning jerseys in Chicago.
Well, so what?
Come
on. It's cold there. It's cold there.
That's for warmth?
I don't know. Whatever. How many people are really actually probably burning the jerseys?
Man, I saw 50, some videos, man.
50 or 100? And we can all agree there's probably 50 to 100 idiots in the entire city of Chicago.
Maybe more.
Could be more. What's the population
anyway?
There? 2 million. I'm not going to kick Jay Cutler. I'm not going to kick Mark Trestman. Mel Tucker, I might have to kick a little bit.
Ooh.
I don't mean to be that way. Here's the problem: is they play a vanilla zone coverage and vanilla zone foundation, and you can't play that way if you don't have the pass rush or really the players on the back end. I think the transformation we saw Detroit make this year, where they've always been that kind of defense, and now they bring in Terrell Austin, and they can still play that way, but they have a lot more. They have other flavors around them. They're more. They have more dimension. I think it's time for the Bears to do that. They don't have the Urlacher personnel. Those days, that stuff's gone. Lance Briggs will be gone next year. Tillman's gone next year. They're pretty much out the door now. Tillman's out the door certainly right now.
Yeah.
And it's time to change the approach in Chicago.
Speaking of change, Mel Tucker isn't ready to do that just yet. The team that gave up 451 total yards to the Packers last week, that defense, all 11 starters will start again this week. So nothing immediate.
That's because who are they going to go to?
It's a great question.
It's easy to say, well, they ought to bench some guys, heads out of roll. It's easy for me to say they ought to fire the coordinator. Who are you going to go hire? Because Mel Tucker's been a respected coordinator around the league for a long time. So I don't want to just sit here and say, well, they ought to do this. But seriously, who are they going to bench? I mean, they have the rookie defensive tackles, I guess they could put in, Ego Ferguson, Will Sutton. Those guys have been getting snaps. So on the back end, you're talking about playing Danny McCray at free safety or a strong safety, Sherrick McManus at cornerback, Al Lewis Jean, who got burned in the New England game. They don't have any depth, so of course they're not benching anybody.
And that's why we don't like doing the coaches and the firing, and that's not the kind of conversation we need to have. But you don't want to kick Jay Cutler while he's down, but he just signed that 7-year deal in the offseason, and when's the point where you say it's time to move on?
Because he just signed the deal. I mean, again, it's almost just like what I said with the coordinators.
What can you do better? Yeah.
Who are you going to go for? Yeah, you're just going to go find a new quarterback all of a sudden and then have him learn the whole offense with Trestman and hope that he does it before Brandon Marshall and Alshon Jeffrey's skills start to erode in 3 or 4 years, at least for Marshall.
Well, maybe this is a good exercise where you get to kick the dumb fan out of me, whatever's remaining that you haven't gotten out of me through 10 weeks of this podcast. But that's always wanting the better option when it's not even available. It's just a natural tendency.
There is no better. If Jay Cutler were released tomorrow,
get picked up in a second,
10 teams would be signing up, lining up to go get him. At least 15 teams would probably line up to go get him. The whole, Peter wrote about Jay Cutler's body language this week, and I thought it was an interesting piece. I thought it was really well done, and it really made me think. I've always had this issue with body language because I used to get on the Mannings about their body language pre-Super Bowl days for both of them, actually, especially Peyton. And then when Eli won the Super Bowls,
I
realized
it doesn't matter.
The body language, when things are going well, then the body language, look how cool he is under pressure. It doesn't matter. When things are going poorly, the guy looks disinterested and doesn't care. Cutler's hard to deal with. He's hard to be around. We know that. I don't know what kind of leader he is because I know some guys like him in there. I'm sure some guys really don't like him at all. It's tough to just gauge body language to me. I get what Peter's saying. I totally get it. That you need to see. I think the same thing when I'm watching at home. He's not engaged on the sideline with guys. Who's he talking to? Why isn't he going over stuff with somebody? It's tough to gauge that. I don't know. Look, he goes out and he has a 4-touchdown performance. We forget about his body language.
Really quickly, 99% of the time the statement is unfounded, but when you were watching that Packers-Bears game, can you be honest and say, did you at any point think that the Bears just threw in the towel and that a large majority of those players were done? They were just done.
Well, I thought about watching the fourth quarter to look for that, but I was done.
The only guy that I'm confident would never give up is Brandon Marshall.
Yeah, he's a man. He's a man. And by the way, I want to say, I only turned the game off late, as I've said, because I think you get a false picture of a team when it's a blowout. I don't like to have it in my notes. I don't like to have it in my thoughts because teams suddenly shift their game plans and you get a false picture. It might be fun to watch how the backup performs, but he's not performing against a real situation.
Well, and the Bears aren't the only defense that's struggled so far this season. The Falcons have had a struggling defense for most of the season, but only gave up 17 points to the Bucs last week. They're game out in the NFC South, as bizarre as that could sound.
And they're undefeated in the South, so they'll have a tiebreaker.
Is there hope here, Andy?
Yeah, there is hope.
Uh-oh. I didn't see that coming.
What you just said, we have to respect that. I don't know if we have to respect it. We have to honor we have to respect the validity of it, the logic. I'm okay with the logic of it.
Maybe you only respect it because the Bucks were your NFC South pick. Yeah, I'm not going to let you forget
Twitter
that.
Guy.
Yep,
thanks.
You're back.
I watched the game. I watched a film. It was their best performance of the season, at least that I can remember off the top of my head for Atlanta's defense. Paul Warlew impressed me, which I'm not a big Warlew guy, but I thought he played extremely well. Desmond Trufant had a sensational game. Pass rush made a little bit of noise. They went against a bad Bucs offensive line, but guess what? Good news. They're going against a bad Panthers offensive line.
Maybe worse. Maybe. After what we saw last week.
Maybe worse. The thing with the Bucs is it's a bad offensive line that had backup offensive tackles in at both spots late in the game. So it might – whatever it is, it's – look, they're going to match up well to Carolina. Atlanta's going to match up well to this team. And their receivers are going to be a handful for that secondary. The Panthers' secondary has started to show the cracks that we knew existed already with Kaysen getting benched. And after he had a nice start to the season, that went the wrong direction in a hurry. And Melvin White is not necessarily he's a guy that teams like to play against, as they say. Josh Norman's not anything. I mean, these guys aren't going to be able to defend Julio Jones and Roddy White.
You know, what's crazy about even talking about the Falcons being within one game of the division lead in the NFC South is that they've only beat two teams. I mean, they get three wins twice against Tampa Bay. How can you even say that this is a good indicator, even if you look at this last week against the Bucs, when you've only beat two teams and one of them's arguably one of the worst teams in the NFL?
Well, if they hadn't beat the Bucs, and we wouldn't be saying that about the Bucs, we'd be saying Atlanta's the worst team in the NFL because they'd be the 1-17.
I think it's a very close race.
You know, so you don't buy in the Atlanta thing.
I don't. I mean, I think Trufant has been good. I think that is a good point, but I think it's easy to see improvements in the 31st best defense in yardage and the worst pass defense in the league.
No, you could be right. I mean, I'm just trying to put a positive.
That's right.
I was trying to put a positive.
Sorry.
And also,
sorry, Falcons,
I believe they can beat Carolina. I want to get out in front on this thing.
Okay.
Because they'll be 4-6, and people will be talking about them as sleepers again.
And making the run.
Yeah, I just want to be part of the group, John.
Yeah. You've always been one of those guys to conform, haven't you? And then your sexy pick to win that NFC South, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, on the road against Washington, looking for that second win of the season. But Washington's coming off the bye. RG3 saw some action 2 weeks ago, and he didn't look too bad.
No, I thought he did look kind of bad.
Oh, man.
I thought
– I just keep missing the ball on these things.
Well, I know. I can see why you said he didn't look too bad, because there were some plays that were made.
But flashes. It was more flash plays like we've seen all over his career.
He didn't, but he left some throws on the field like we've seen all over his career. He doesn't look as fast either anymore. I don't think his speed is there anymore. Not, I mean, he's not a slug.
Call Adidas, get a new shoe.
They're going to have to live with the ups and downs of Robert Griffin right now because there are certain things he should be doing that he doesn't do from the pocket. He's not a refined pocket player at this point.
Well, can you quickly shut down any fan that says keep McCoy in there, that it needs to be RG3?
I don't know if I can quickly shut that down. I'm not saying I would not propose that idea. I'm not in support of that, but there would be an argument for it because McCoy can't make all the throws, but he knows he can't make all the throws. RG3 can make all the throws. It's the throws he doesn't attempt that drive me crazy or that he throws.
He seems to second guess himself a lot too.
Or just I don't think he sees things. I don't think he's an anticipation passer at this point. I don't think he has a good sense for how routes interact with
coverages.
Is he
one of those see it guys like you've mentioned?
Yeah, perhaps. Yeah. And those see it guys, you know, some of those guys have stayed that way. I think it's on Gruden. I think this is the whole RG3 project is to make him not that way. He's going to have to become an anticipation guy because some guys can get away playing as a see it guy. Like Tom Brady's actually kind of a see it guy. I'm sure he can anticipate, but his style of play, he prefers to see it.
What?
And Cam Newton's a see it guy, but he can take the hits. RG3, he can't sustain the punishment that comes with being a see it guy because what happens is sometimes you see it, but the defenders, by the time you see it, the defenders get on you. Roethlisberger could take those hits. Newton can maybe take them, although he's
Luck.
Getting banged up. Yeah, Luck's not a see it guy.
No,
though.
But taking hits.
Yeah, taking hits. RG3 is delicate, though, which is why you're going to have to make him something that he's really not right now.
And speaking of Andrew Luck, obviously, like you said, not one of those see it passers, but a guy we love to examine and a guy you've become very fond of, Andy. We have the MMQB's Greg Bedard joining us. And Greg, you wrote an article a couple weeks ago that tacitly scolded my partner here, Andy, with Andrew Luck being the second coming in the NFL. And before we let you two duke it out, share with our listeners just kind of your overall position on Andrew Luck in the NFL.
First of all, I got to give Andy a lot of credit for writing that, because I remember seeing the cover and I was like, huh, that's, you know, Andy's already on the cover of the magazine. Great for him. And I was like, you know, I was a little bit jealous. I hadn't had my cover on Marcus Mariota yet, so I was a little jealous. But then I got to thinking of it more about it, and I was like, yeah, if this was the subject matter that they came to me with, I'd be like, I can't write that yet. I just can't. And part of that, part of where the column came from is that that's just the way I've been throughout my career. Like, I'm not a projection guy. That's not my strength. Most of my strength is saying, you know, whether it's a college guy or a guy in the NFL, like, I could say, all right, this guy I think can play, or, you know, whatever his level might be, but I have a hard time, you know, projecting people. And so that being said, the genesis of the column had actually been a few weeks in the making. It was something that, you know, because I hadn't watched a ton of Andrew Luck live. I had watched him on film. And I was watching, I think it was the Texans game, where they almost blew that game, and Luck made a couple of what I thought crucial mistakes. And then I got to thinking more about Andrew Luck in kind of big spots, and I was thinking, you know, he makes a lot of kind of big mistakes, and you know, you don't really hear people talking about that. I mean, in my experience, and maybe I've tuned some things out, I have thought that Andrew Luck thus far in his career has gotten no flack for anything that he's ever done. And so I was like, oh, you know, maybe I'll file it away. And then I was watching the Steelers game, and saw him throw the pick six, and they had the safety in the end zone, which, you know, I mean, it wasn't really his fault, and those kind of plays happen. I mean, that the column wasn't really about the safety. And so I started going back to sort of the crucial games this year, the crucial games last year, the playoff game, both playoff games. And I said, you know what? You know, Andrew Luck, over his short career so far, has made a lot of, well, I wouldn't say a lot, but he's made some crucial mistakes and things that I would rip other people for. For example, you know, Colin Kaepernick, who I've been rough on in his career. And I said, you know what, I think it's time for me to say that Andrew Luck hasn't been great yet. And the headline on the story did me no favors, since it just said Andrew Luck isn't great. yeah. Wasn't exactly my choice. It would have been nice to see a yet on the end of that.
Yeah.
Because that's sort of what my column was about. I mean, you know, I said, outside of Aaron Rodgers, I think he's the most talented quarterback in the league right now, and he makes, you know, 5 to 6 to 8, depending on the game, throws that, you know, as an analyst, just take your breath away, that other guys just can't make, especially at his age, don't make. But that being said, and I do think that he, in short order, will be one of the greats in the league. I just don't think he's there yet. I need to see more. I need to see him make less mistakes in the big games, and then he can have the crown. But I just thought, you know, it had been something on my mind. I thought it needed to be said, and as a result, I'm extremely popular in the state of Indiana.
Now, I don't see Andy's blood boil very often, but I can already see him fired up here.
John, you're... See, this is the problem. I was hoping Greg would be more Skip Bayless-y and we could go back and forth. But you watch too much film.
I mean,
right?
I have my anecdotal evidence. You know, a little bit prepared. I'm sure Andy has you know, folders prepared on this
volumes,
along with the fat head of Andrew Luck that he has on his wall with hearts around it. I'm sure that's the backdrop, but yeah, I mean, look, you know, is the guy going to be great? Yeah. I mean, there's a 90, 95%, maybe 99%. he is. There's no question that out of the younger quarterbacks, he's going to be the guy. I mean, there's no question in my mind that he's going to be the guy. He has all the traits. And in fact, I said this on Boston Radio the other day. I do a spot every Tuesday for a couple hours. I said that I think that Luck is going to be better than Peyton Manning in a lot of ways, because I think he has the toughness and intangibles that I don't always see from Peyton Manning. And I am not a Peyton Manning guy. I have never been a Peyton Manning guy. I think he's a great regular season quarterback. But I think being a great quarterback in this league is about more than that. And, you know, I think Luck has a chance. Actually, I think he has a very good chance that I think he's going to do what Peyton did but be even better in the postseason. I just don't think he's there yet, and I think people make too many excuses for him. And Sunday night against the Patriots is a perfect time for him to shut me the hell up.
Well, so what I see when I watch Andrew Luck, and I understand what you're saying, Greg, and I don't disagree with it. And this is going to sound ridiculous, but what I like is to speak to Luck. Speaking about Luck's mistakes, I think so many of them come out of positive situations or almost good intentions. He's making mistakes because he's being asked to complete plays that other guys couldn't even fathom. And sometimes you're going to get mistakes with that. Sometimes you're going to get the spectacular with Luck. Now, you're right. That Pittsburgh game, though, that interception, that who was it? Was it Gay that got it?
I think it was.
Yeah. You know, that's an inexcusable type mistake, certainly. And I think with Luck, we do see some of that, the young guy syndrome. And I bet he would be the first to tell you that.
Yep.
But
based on this, your story that I reread today, I think he would.
Yeah, and he's very diligent in that regard. And I don't think he doesn't give a crap about this conversation that we're having. I don't think this stuff registers with him.
Right.
I just love when I watch film, especially, but any games, I like to look at what are guys being asked to do, or what are they trying to do? Because at the NFL level, at the overall in the big scheme, most guys can do most things, or what they're trying to do, they can complete and they can succeed on, but they can't all attempt the same stuff. Do you know what I'm saying, Greg?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know. That's where I have fallen in love with Luck, is that you put on the film, and yeah, he plays like a rookie at times, or he plays like a second or third year guy, a young guy. But the outcome is like that. But the stuff he's doing, the attempt, and where the offense is flowing around him is not like that. And I don't think I've ever seen anything like it before.
I wouldn't disagree with that. But you know, I kind of, you know, and I don't. I would say, you know, in my judgment, the way I watch film is, you know, I think that is a little bit grading on a curve. I mean, because I think that the coaches give players what they're capable of, and obviously Luck is capable of a lot more than a lot of guys. But I don't, you know, I don't expect him to be perfect, and I'm a guy who likes interceptions because it means you're trying to make plays.
Yeah. There
are a lot of guys in this league who aren't trying to make plays and just don't throw interception. I think that was
Alex
a problem.
Alex Smith.
Right.
That's
and
perfect
I think
example.
That's actually it was a criticism that I had of, you know, Aaron Rodgers when I first covered him when he broke in as a starter in 2008. I covered him 2008, 2009, half of 2010. I thought that, you know, Rodgers just went the other way in trying to be the anti-Favre, that he didn't want to make those mistakes, and I thought he went too far, and he finally found the right balance. And I think, you know, I think when I watch Luck and sort of the lack of criticism that he gets, you know, I compare it to Aaron Rodgers. And it was a bit different because, you know, the Packers were coming off an NFC championship game appearance. He was following Brett Favre. Things went badly. But, you know, Aaron Rodgers, when I covered him, and including for myself, he got a lot of criticism. And a lot of valid criticism for trying to do too many things, holding on to the ball too long. And I think that Luck has – I don't think it's been fair that he's skated on that. Yeah, he's asked to do a lot. Maybe he doesn't have the greatest talent around him, even though I think especially starting this season, you know, I think that people are shortchanging the Colts. I think that they're a little better than people give them credit for. And so I just think that I think that Luck, you know, now that he's in the middle of his third season, and this is sort of where Rodgers took off, I want to see him take off because I think it's time. I threw out his rookie season because of what they're rebuilding from, and he was a rookie. He's been in the Stanford offense with Pep Hamilton. I think those mistakes that we've seen, and this goes back to a lot of things, like, you know, the Chiefs playoff game, he helped put them into a huge hole. Yeah, he helped get them out of it. I would put that more on the Chiefs giving that game away. And I think that if the Chiefs didn't give that game away, I think that Luck would be getting more criticism, but he helped them come back, and he had a great final quarter and a half. And then he comes out in the Patriots game. You know, you talk about errors that, you know, he's almost, you know, trying too hard and being asked to do certain things. I mean, that pick to Alphonso Dennerin on the opening possession, that's the kind of stuff I'm talking about. And he does that a lot more than people want to talk about. And I just think it, now at this point in his career, he needs to get past it to take the next step. And I think, you know, and he could be very well like Rodgers. Rodgers in his third year of starting took off, led him to a Super Bowl. Luck is fully capable of that, but I think it's time for him to take the next step, and I think it needs to start Sunday night. I think this is a spot, depending on the health of the Colts, and it's a little shaky. You're at home. Both teams have had a week off. This is a huge game as far as AFC playoff seeding. This is a game Andrew Luck should win, and if he doesn't win it and he makes mistakes, I think people need to take a closer look at him.
All right, Greg, in the most general way possible, where would you then rank Luck in this grand scheme of quarterbacks in the NFL?
Oh, that's a good question. I'd put Brady and Manning, are up there, and Rodgers. I would say they are the upper echelon.
The Holy
right now.
Trinity, yeah.
Yeah, and then I'd say that Luck is sort of, in that next group of guys, whether it's, you know, depending on what kind of protection he gets, you know, Breeze is certainly there and could be with the top three. Rivers as well. Roethlisberger, obviously. I would say, you know, he's in that group. I would say he's towards the back of that group now, but all he needs to do is stop. You know, it's something that I wrote for tomorrow. I made the joke that in Indianapolis, the Peyton Manning face has been replaced by the Andrew Luck two-headed helmet slam. Like, I'm an idiot. Because, I mean, you see him do that multiple times, and he's right. But I certainly think he's up there. I would just say he's in that second wave.
Yeah, and I would agree with Greg. I mean, I think the second wave and the first wave are a little more blurred than top three. Because I think Roethlisberger there's a discussion about that. I don't think Breeze is quite at the top anymore, so he's probably. I guess I'd put Roethlisberger in the first wave with Luck, and I think I'd have Luck slightly ahead of him. But we're splitting hairs, and like Greg said, some of it has to do with protection and all that. I think we get out on this and just both agree that if you have him as your franchise quarterback, you're not in a bad spot.
Right. I mean, no question. And just one thing that I wanted to point out. I mean, when I just want to see him play a little bit better in the bigger games. I mean, in the past 2 years, I did this out, he's against teams less than 500, and this is towards the end of the season, or at least for this year, it looks like teams that are going to miss the playoffs. You know, he's 11-1. He's completed 62% of his passes. He's got a 97.4 rating, 26 touchdowns, 8 interceptions. Against teams that are 500 or better, in his career, the past 2 years, he's 7-8. He's completed 60% of his passes. He's got 29 touchdowns, 17 interceptions. That's sort of the thing that I'm talking about. I just want to see a little bit more consistency, especially with the interceptions, in these bigger games. But there's no question, Andy. I think we can both agree that, if I had the number one pick in the draft this year, a redraft, it would be Andrew Luck, and I think that he is, without question, has the best chance of any of the younger quarterbacks of being the next great quarterback, and I think he'll be there in short order. I just want to see him get there a little bit sooner.
This is great. I think we found some common ground here.
Oh, yeah, no question. Hey, thanks, Greg. We always appreciate it.
All right, appreciate it, Greg.
No problem. Thanks, guys.
And we'll wrap up here with our Monday night game. The Pittsburgh Steelers 6-4 going on the road against the Tennessee Titans. The Jets were able to snub the Steelers last week 20-13, getting the win in week 10. Why have the Steelers been so streaky, Andy?
I don't know. It's a bizarre one. I think it has to do with turnovers, though. And when they turn the ball over.
Especially last week.
Yeah. I mean, Roethlisberger had two interceptions that were off based on that derived from him being off target. And Antonio Brown gave the Jets led to 10 points with his fumbles on the punt return and on the screen pass. That was the difference in the game, too, by the way. The Steelers did not come out and play horrible football last week. They had bad turnovers that they paid a price for. That happens in the NFL. But I think it has something to do also with the ability. All right, so they're creating turnover. They're giving away turnovers, but they're also not creating very many turnovers. And maybe that has something to do with it. I don't know. It's bizarre to see a veteran team with good players and a good scheme play up and down to its competition the way Pittsburgh does.
And it almost feels weird even accusing the Steelers of being streaky at this stage. I think they were really streaky in those first 4 to 5 weeks, but they've won three of their last four against some good teams, too. Colts, Baltimore, Houston. I mean, I guess you can wipe
Houston,
off Houston.
No, Houston's not a bad team.
Not a bad team. But then going up against the Jets, that is still a road game, and it wasn't as far off, like you were mentioning, as it may look.
Yeah, but boy, God, the Jets are 1-8, right? I mean, it's so.
But you also get the game of Michael Vick's life.
No. Really? Is that what people are saying?
It sure seemed like it during that game. He was making some incredible throws.
Well, he had the touchdown throw against
the. Yeah, that's right, the bomb.
I guarantee you that was a game plan play where they knew that if they lined up in that three tight end look with all three tight ends to one side and just one wide receiver out of a single back set, they knew that they'd get Pittsburgh to react the way they did. And Mike Mitchell dropped down, so he was not a single high safety. He was just almost no safety. And he reacted to the run look, which I understand why he would. And then they played cover three on the outside. And if Mike Mitchell's reacting to that run look, then the cover three corners have no one helping them in the middle of the field. And that's where the deep ball went. And it was designed that way all the way. And they knew Pittsburgh on first down like that would play cover three, and they beat him with it. So you could say that could be Michael Vick having the game of his life. And the game of his life, by the way, was a Monday night game against Washington a few years ago.
There you go. Yeah,
where he had some
you're
other
right.
deep balls. But you could also say Marty Morningwig had the game of his life. And I'm sure Morningwig has had better games as well. Though the Jets, they did some good things in that game. They had the play I just described, and that was to T.J. Graham, right? And then they had Percy Harvin. I thought they used him correctly, especially early in the game. When you use Harvin early in the game as a misdirection guy, then it's hard to, you know, it sets the tone for the rest of the game. The defense has to worry about that. Why I bring that up is because Tennessee does have the ability to do some of those things. They're going to create some defined throws or specific game plan throws against that Steeler coverage because other teams have had success against Pittsburgh's cover three. But they're also going to be able to use Dexter McCluster a little bit like Harvin. And I would expect that they do that early in the game to get the Steelers playing east and west. Because when they play east and west, I still don't think they're as good of a defense when they get going that way.
You know, in the AFC North, with the way that the Cleveland Browns are playing, they're 6-3. There's not a lot of room to slip up if you're the Steelers. So where does that consistency that we're saying they're streaky, do you end that streakiness with shoring up the turnovers? Is that really all that's left there? Or because the defense,
what else can they do to get
better? Well, the defense has kind of gotten back on track around like week five. So
yeah, but to me, being on track for the Steeler defense is forcing turnovers, is getting sacks. Because their whole mantra is, all right, so they're going to play that cover three. They're going to play the matchup zone stuff. You're going to give up some plays doing that because you play off coverage when you do it. You have to be pretty safe on the back end. And so 5-yard throws, 8-yard throws, those things, you can have those against Pittsburgh. Their thinking is at some point, though, you're going to make a mistake as an offense. And when you do, we're going to pounce on you. Or when we get you, when those mistakes lead to third and long, then we're going to change our defense and come after you, and we're going to get you that way. And they have not been getting teams that way. They haven't been making teams pay for the mistakes and forcing the turnovers. They haven't been getting all the sacks. But I'm more encouraged by them than I was early in the season because you're right, what you said, the defense has been better lately. It just, it didn't play well, and it played okay in this game. Just didn't do anything to win the game.
Well, and it's really easy to fall in love with that Steelers offense too, with all the weapons that we've talked about over the years. You know what? Or over the years, over the weeks. You know what's a fun little tidbit here? I think you might like this. Martavis Bryant, his 6 touchdowns are the most in league history through a player's first 4 games.
Really?
Isn't that something?
I do like that. Yeah, that's a great.
That
surprises me.
He's been
really
a great asset for Ben Roethlisberger.
Didn't Randy Moss jump on the scene though early? I mean, I'm not. I'm sure that your stat would have that accounted for.
All right, so looking up Randy Moss right now, he had 4 touchdowns through those
in that 98 season.
That's right. Yeah.
What did he finish with that year?
That year, let's see here. Looks like he finished with 17 in 98.
Okay. Yeah, I kind of miss Randy Moss.
Yeah, no, I think we all miss Randy Moss and
was
all
just,
of his
the
antics.
League was fun when we were talking about him. Is he playing hard? Is he not playing hard? What's up with Moss?
He was like Jay Cutler as a wide receiver.
Yeah, a little,
a little bit. All right, guys, that's all we have for you for week 11. We'll see you week 12. Don't forget to subscribe to the MMQB podcast on iTunes. Get it right in your mailbox every Thursday morning. That's all we have. I'm John. He's Andy. We'll see you next week.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.